court-martial testimony. Question. Did you see any bodies shot? Answer.
Right, sir.
Women and children?
Right, sir. Women and children? About 25 of them in the northeastern part of My Lai.
Did you see any other bodies?
Right, sir. About 10 of them in that place north of My Lai. They were all women, and they were all nude.
Were there any soldiers from your platoon there?
Right, sir. Roshevitz, he was there. He had an M79. Those women? They died from a canister round from his M79.
Leonard Gonzalez, court-martial testimony. Exhibit 8. John Wade's box of tricks, partial list. Deck of playing cards. All the jack of diamonds. Thumb tip fake. Photographs, 12, of father. Pack of chewing gum. Bronze star with V device. Purple hearts, 2. Army commendation medal. Combat infantryman's badge. Waxed rope. Adhesive false mustache. Vodka bottle, empty. Book, mental magic. Book, feats of levitation. Question. What were they firing at? Answer. At the enemy, sir.
At people?
At the enemy, sir.
They weren't human beings?
Yes, sir.
They were human beings?
Yes, sir.
Were they men?
I don't know, sir.
I would imagine they were, sir.
Didn't you see?
Pardon, sir?
Did you see them?
I wasn't discriminating.
Did you see women?
I don't know, sir.
What do you mean you weren't discriminating?
I didn't discriminate between individuals in the village, sir.
They were all the enemy. They were all to be destroyed, sir. William Calley, court-martial testimony. It is a crucial moment in a soldier's life when he is ordered to perform a deed that he finds completely at variance with his own notions of right and good. Probably for the first time, he discovers that an act someone else thinks to be necessary is for him criminal. Suddenly, the soldier feels himself abandoned and cast off from all security. Conscience has isolated him, and its voice is a warning. If you do this, you will not be at peace with me in the future. You can do it, but you ought not. You must act as a man, and not as an instrument of another's will. J. Glenn Gray, The Warriors. The violation of human connection, and consequently the risk of a post-traumatic stress disorder, is highest of all when the survivor has been not merely a passive witness, but also an active participant in violent death or atrocity. Judith Herman, Trauma and Recovery. Question. Did you receive any hostile fire at all any time that day? Answer.
No, sir.
Frank Beardsley, court-martial testimony. Question. Did you obey your orders? Answer.
Yes, sir.
What were your orders?
Kill anything that breathed.
Salvatore Lamartina, court-martial testimony.
John! John! Oh, John!
George Armstrong Custer. Footnote. Evan S. Connell, Son of the Morning Star. San Francisco, North Point Press, 1984. Page 307. Connell writes that John was the name ordinarily used by whites when addressing an Indian. At the Little Bighorn, on June 25, 1876, one terrified trooper was heard sobbing this name, as though it might save his life. John! John! Oh, John! This plea echoes horribly down 100 years. End of note.
Fucking flies.
Richard Thinbill.
I just went. My mind just went. And I wasn't the only one that did it. A lot of other people did it. I just killed. Once I started the training, the whole programming part of killing, it just came out. I just followed suit. I just lost all sense of direction, of purpose. I just started killing any kind of way I could kill. It just came. I didn't know I had it in me.
Varnado Simpson, Charlie Company, 2nd Platoon,
Question. Then what happened? Answer.
Lieutenant Callie came out and said, take care of these people. So we said, okay. So we stood there and watched them. He went away. Then he came back and said, I thought I told you to take care of these people. We said, we are. He said, I mean, kill them. I was a little stunned and I didn't know what to do. I stood behind them and they stood side by side. So they, Callie and Meadlow, got online and fired directly into the people. It was automatic. The people screamed and yelled and fell. I guess they tried to get up, too. They couldn't. That was it. The people were pretty well messed up. Lots of heads was shot off. Pieces of heads and pieces of flesh flew off the sides and arms. Dennis Conti, court-martial testimony. The dismounted troopers then ran downhill and slid into the ravine where their bodies were found. They must have felt helplessly exposed and rushed toward the one place that might protect them. Yet the moment they skidded into the gully, they were trapped. All they could do was hug the sides or crouch among the bushes, looking fearfully upward and wait. A few tried to scramble up the south wall because the earth showed boot marks and furrows probably gouged by their fingers, but none of these tracks reached the surface. Evan S. Connell, son of the Morning Star. Question. Can you describe them? Answer. They was women and little kids. What were they doing? They were lying on the ground, bleeding from all over. They was dead. Renard Doines, court-martial testimony. Question. Did you have any conversation with Lieutenant Callie at that ditch? Answer. Yes. What did he say? He asked me to use my machine gun. At the ditch? Yes. What did you say? I refused. Robert Maples, court-martial testimony. Question. Did you ever open your pants in front of a woman in the village of Milai? Answer. No. Isn't it a fact that you were going through Milai that day looking for women? No. Didn't you carry a woman half-nude on your shoulders and throw her down and say that she was too dirty to rape? You did that, didn't you? Oh, yeah, but it wasn't at Milai. Dennis Conti, court-martial testimony. Every man has some reminiscences, which he would not tell to everyone, but only to his friends. He has others which he would not reveal even to his friends, but only to himself, and that in secret. But finally, there are still others which a man is even afraid to tell himself, and every decent man has a considerable number of such things stored away. Man is bound to lie about himself. Fyodor Dostoevsky, Notes from Underground. Married veterans, or guys who married when they got back, had difficulties too. Waking up with your hands around your wife's throat is frightening to the vet and to the wife. Is he crazy? Does he hate me? What the hell's going on? Patience H.C. Mason, recovering from the war. Like I told you, he used to yell things in his sleep. Bad things. Kathy thought he needed help. Patricia S. Hood. Something was wrong with the guy. No shit, I could almost smell it. Vincent R. Vinnie Pearson. The crimes visited on the inhabitants of Sonmi Village included individual and group acts of murder, rape, sodomy, maiming, assault on non-combatants, and the mistreatment and killing of detainees. Colonel William V. Wilson, U.S. Army Investigator. Footnote. The number of civilian casualties during operations in Sonmi Village on March 16, 1968, is a matter of continuing dispute. The Piers Commission concluded that at least 175 to 200 Vietnamese men, women, and children were killed in the course of the March 16th operation. The U.S. Army's Criminal Investigation Division, CID, estimated on the basis of census data that the casualties may have exceeded 400. At the Sonmi Memorial, which I visited in the course of research for this book, the number is fixed at 504. An amazing experience, by the way.
Tuan Yen is still a quiet little farming village, very poor, very remote, with dirt paths and cow dung and high bamboo hedgerows. Very friendly, all things considered. The old folks nod and smile. The children giggle at our white foreign faces. The ditch is still there. I found it easily. Just 5 or 6 feet deep, shallow and unimposing. Yet it was as if I had been there before, in my dreams or in some other life. Chapter 17. The Nature of Politics. In late November of 1968, John Wade extended his tour for an extra year. He had no meaningful choice. After what happened at Tuan Yen, he'd lost touch with some defining part of himself. He couldn't extricate himself from the slime. "It's the personal decision," he wrote Kathy. "Maybe someday I'll be able to explain it, but right now I can't leave this place. I have to take care of a few things. Otherwise, I won't ever get home. Not the right way." Kathy's response when it finally came was enigmatic. She loved him. She hoped it wasn't a career move. Over the next months, John Wade did his best to apply the trick of forgetfulness. He paid attention to his soldiering. He was promoted twice, first to Spec 4, then to Buck Sergeant. And in time he learned to comport himself with modest dignity under fire. It wasn't valor, but it was a start. In the first week of December, he received a nasty flesh wound in the mountains west of Chulai. A month later, he took a half pound of shrapnel in the lower back and thighs. He needed the pain. He needed to reclaim his own virtue. At times, he went out of his way to confront hazard, walking point or leading night patrols, which were acts of erasure, a means of burying one great horror under the weight of many smaller horrors. Sometimes the trick almost worked. Sometimes he almost forgot. In November of 1969, John Wade returned home with a great many decorations. 5 months later, he married Kathy in an outdoor ceremony, pink and white balloons bobbing from the trees. And just before Easter, they moved into the apartment in Minneapolis. "We'll be happy," Kathy said. "I know it." John laughed and carried her inside. They decorated the place with hanging plants and printed fabrics stretched over wooden frames. They had fun shopping together, picking out cheap furniture and rugs and a portable television. They used the floor for lovemaking until Kathy found a decent secondhand bed. "There, you see," she said. "I was right." John began law school that fall, which was part of the plan. And in late August of 1973, he passed the bar on his first try. A week later, he went to work as an assistant legislative counsel with the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party. It was nuts and bolts work, with a salary next to nothing. But he was prepared to bear the sacrifices. For more than 3 years, he herded legislation through the State House, where he discharged favors and tucked away IOUs for future redemption. The war seemed light years away. On the morning of their fifth anniversary, John carried Kathy's breakfast into the bedroom on a plastic tray. He caused 5 red roses to appear under cover of a dish towel. "It's funny," she said. "You seem different somehow. More relaxed or content or something." "You think so?" "Yes, and I'm glad." John nodded at her. He showed his empty hands, made a move, and displayed a pair of glass earrings. He caused a pair of new white tennis shoes to appear. On the insteps he had written John and Kath, encircling this combination with hearts. All the tricks were working. In the early spring of 1976, he announced his candidacy for the Minnesota State Senate. "You want to win?" Tony Carbo said. "Obviously. I'm talking real wanting, stomach wanting." "It's there," Wade said. "Exactly there, in the stomach." Tony nodded and pinched a roll of flesh at his chin. They were not close friends, and never would be, but there was a compatibility between them, a precise matching of opposites. Lock and key, Tony called it. They'd met at a party fundraiser 2 years earlier. A few dinners, a few lunches, and afterward things were assumed.
"Well, beautiful," Tony said. "You're hungry? That's a start. Nothing beats a healthy appetite."
He stared dubiously at one of Kathy's wall hangings, then deposited himself on the couch and looked up at John with a pair of small, slanted eyes. As a human specimen, he wasn't much. Obese and jowly and yellow-skinned. Now, as always, he wore his standard green corduroy suit and stained red tie. His breath came in shallow gusts.
"So how about it?" John said. "On board?"
"Ah, sure."
Tony grinned and glanced over at Kathy. He lit up a cigarette.
"Handsome candidate. Spectacular wife."
"I'm not running on handsome."
"Oh, my," Tony said. "Woe is us."
Kathy looked at him with distaste. Tony beamed at her.
"So what's the pitch? War hero?"
"No heroics," John said. "Straight issues."
"Oh, I see."
Tony leaned back heavily and aimed a smile at Kathy through the smoke.
"Well, listen, we've got a problem then, a big one, because you won't find this Mr. Issue listed on the ballot. Other guys, sure, but not him." He chuckled. "Thought you wanted to win."
"Not like that," Kathy said.
"Beg pardon?"
"John wants to do things, accomplish things. That's the point of it." Tony was still grinning at her.
"Spectacular. Didn't I say that? And I appreciate the input. Except in the real world, you don't accomplish zip without winning. Losers just lose."
He rearranged his weight on the sofa. For a few seconds, he seemed to be considering a number of amusing options.
"This whole game, politics, it's like hustling a woman. Same principle, more or less."
Kathy rolled her eyes but said nothing.
"Wrap your mind around it," Tony said. "You're at a party, say. You spot this hot looker across the room, this real babe. So you wander over and start politicking. Nice firm handshake, look her in the eye, talk about every damn thing under the sun. Talk about Aristotle and Gandhi, how these guys affected you on a deep personal level, how they changed your life forever. Tell about your merit badges, that terrible experience you had with polio, what a sensitive human being you are. And then after a while, real polite, you invite this broad to dinner. Blow a month's pay, shovel out the oysters and caviar. Pretty soon, she starts to owe you. It's never said like that, not direct, but this little pumpkin knows the rules. She knows how the deal works. Code of commerce, so to speak. Anyhow, the whole time you keep talking up your qualifications, how you're nuts about public TV, etc., ad shittum, the spiel's important, right? Whining and dining, all the courtship stuff. You got to do it. Because this girl's human, just like you and me. She's got an ego. She's got her dignity. I mean, she's a living, breathing piece of ass, and you got to respect that."
Tony's gaze slid along the floor toward Kathy.
"A metaphor," he said.
John Wade spent 6 years in the state Senate. Tony ran the campaigns, which were slick and expensive, but the numbers increased nicely over the years, the margins almost tripling between 1976 and 1980. Among his colleagues in the state house, John was regarded as a comer. He knew how to get along with people, how to twist arms without causing fractures. Compromise, he came to realize, was the motor that made government move. And while an idealist in many ways, a Humphrey progressive, a believer in the fundamental human equities, he found his greatest pleasure in the daily routine of legislative politics, the give and take, the maneuvering. Almost by instinct, he knew when to yield and what to require in return. He was smart and discreet. People liked him. Early on, with practice, he cultivated an aspect of shyness in his public demeanor, a boyish quality that inspired trust. And by the end of his first term in 1980, this and numerous other virtues had been noted in important places. The papers rated him as one of the hot young stars. There was talk about a future at higher levels. John's attitude toward all this was straightforward. He had humane instincts. He genuinely wanted to do good in the world. In certain private moments, without ever pondering it too deeply, he was struck by the dim notion of politics as a medium of apology, a way of salvaging something in himself and in the world. Still, Tony Kerber was right. Politics was his profession, and there was nothing dishonorable about presenting himself as a winner. He wore expensive suits, watched his weight, nursed friendships where friendships mattered. Slender and sandy-haired, bony in the face, he photographed well, especially with Kathy at his side, and as a public figure he had the sort of presence that made people pay attention. On the dinner circuit he was modest and articulate, but it was never the sort of smoothness that could be mistaken for insincerity. This, too, was something he cultivated, sincerity. He worked on his posture, his gestures, his trademark style, manipulation. That was still the fun of it. The state Senate ate up huge chunks of time, including weekends and most holidays. And as a consequence, his life with Kathy sometimes suffered. They were happy, of course, but it was a happiness directed toward the future. They deferred things. Vacations and children, and a house of their own. At night, sometimes they would pore through a stack of travel brochures, making lists of resorts and fancy hotels. But in the end, there was always the next campaign to pay for, the next election. And money was always a problem. They cut back on luxuries. They learned to be versatile with credit cards. In his off hours, and when the legislature was out of session, John supplemented his income with work for a St. Paul law firm. And in the autumn of 1981, Kathy took a full-time job in the admissions office at the University of Minnesota, which helped cover the bills. But even then, they felt some strain. At times it seemed as if they were making their way up a huge white mountain, always struggling, sometimes just hanging on. And for both of them, the trick was to remain patient, to keep their eyes fixed on the summit where all the prizes were. They tried to be optimistic, but on occasion it was hard to keep believing. They didn't go out much. They didn't have real friends. They rarely found the energy to make love. "It's strange," Kathy said one evening. "Back in college, we'd just screw and screw, a couple of rabbits. Now it feels sort of..." She bit down as if to check herself. "I don't know. Sometimes it feels like I'm living with this door. I keep trying to get in. I keep pushing. But the damn thing's stuck shut and I just can't budge it." "I'm not a door," John said. "And I'm not stuck." "It feels that way." "Then I'm sorry. We'll fix it." She looked straight at him. Maybe it was the light, he thought. But her eyes had a strange silvery cast. "John, listen. I don't know if anything's really sacred to you. Final and sacred." "Us," he said. "Your tongue, my mouth. No one else's. Forever." "You aren't keeping anything from me?" "That's ridiculous." "Is it?" "Yes," he said. "Totally." She glanced away for a second, then sighed and looked back at him. "Except you wouldn't ever tell, would you? I mean, if there were secrets, you wouldn't ever let on." John took her in his arms. He feigned a teasing laugh, a clear conscience. He was terrified of losing her, and always had been. But he did not say that. "Nonsense," he said. "I love you, Kath. We're aces." "You are clean?" Tony Carbo said. "I am." "No ghosts?" "None." "But like if there's something in your closet, some deep, dark shit with little girls?" "Nothing." "For sure?" John smiled and said, "Positive." "Well, let's hope so," Tony said. "Because you damn well better be. There's any snot up your nose, somebody'll dig it out and squish the stuff right up against your forehead. Sooner or later, man, it's bound to happen. That means for sure. Small-time politics, you can hide the boogers. Not in the big leagues." "I understand." "So you're safe?" John looked away for a moment. A red ditch flashed across his field of vision. "Right," he
he said.
Safe. Tony nodded and picked up a notepad.
What about religion? You've got religion, I hope to Christ.
I'll find it.
Lutheran. Fine with me.
Terrific. Church once a week, 10 o'clock sharp. Tony flicked his eyebrows.
I got this feeling we're going to have a genuine God-fearing Lutheran for Lieutenant Governor.
Again, John Wade won big, by more than 60,000 votes, then spent the next 4 years cutting ribbons. Predictably, the lieutenant governorship was a do-nothing job, worse than tedious. But from the beginning, he viewed it as little more than a stop along the way. He ran errands, paid attention to his party work, kept his face in the papers. If a Kiwanis club up in Duluth needed a luncheon speaker, he'd make the drive and tell a few jokes over chicken fricassee and give off a winner's golden glow. Already, he had his sights locked on the U.S. Senate. In July of 1982, Kathy told him she was pregnant. In bed that night, John held her close. They were young, he told her. Plenty of time. They were near the top of that mountain they'd been climbing. Almost there. One last push, and then they'd rustle up a whole house full of kids. In the morning, John made a phone call. Forms were signed. A freckled young doctor explained things, then sent them out to the waiting room. Kathy paged through magazines while John tried to concentrate on a framed print of grazing cattle. When the nurse called her, Kathy smoothed out her skirt and stood up.
Well, she said, keep an eye on my purse.
John watched a swinging door compress the air behind her. And then for an indeterminate period of time, he sat appraising the grazing cattle. Curiously, he felt the beginnings of sorrow, which perplexed him, and it required effort to direct his thoughts elsewhere. A few phone calls, maybe. Check in with Tony. He looked around for a telephone, half rising, but then some strange force seemed to press him back into the chair. The room wasn't quite solid. Very wobbly, it seemed. And suddenly, as though caught in a box of mirrors, John looked up to see his own image reflected on the clinic's walls and ceiling. Funhouse reflections, deformations and odd angles. He saw a little boy doing magic. He saw a college spy, madly in love. He saw a soldier and a husband and a seeker of public office. He saw himself from inside out and upside down, the organic chemistry, the twisted chromosomes, and for a second it occurred to him that his own stability was at issue. At supper that night he tried to describe the experience to Kathy, except it was hopeless. He couldn't find the words. Kathy's eyes went skipping across the surfaces of things. At one point, he suggested taking a drive.
Drive?
She said. If you're up to it. Kathy regarded him without expression. Her hair was blonde and curly, thinning slightly, the corners of her eyes worn by their years together. All right, he said. No drive. They sat in silence. It was mid-July, warm and humid, and for a long while there was only the sound of knives and forks. Kath, he finally said. Then he stopped and said,
we did the right thing. Did we?
Yes. Bad timing.
Timing, she said.
Next year we can always...
You all right?
She blinked and looked down at the table.
Am I all right? Am I? God, I don't even know. What is all right?
She pushed her plate away.
A baby. It's all I wanted.
I know that.
What else did I ever ask for?
Nothing.
Tell me, what else?
Nothing, he said. They watched TV for an hour. Afterward, Kathy did some ironing, then carried a book back to the bedroom. John waited until well after midnight before turning off the television. He undressed, took a Seconal, and lay down on the couch. The apartment was full of odd noises. He loved her, more than anything. Drifting, feeling the drug,
He closed his eyes and gave himself over to the mirrors in his head. He was awed and a little frightened by all the angles at play. They never talked about it, not directly, not obliquely. On those occasions when it rose up in their minds or when they felt its presence between them, they would carefully funnel the conversation toward safer topics. They would speak in code, or simply go quiet and wait for the mood to change. But for both of them, in different ways, there was now an enduring chill in their lives. Some nights Kathy would wake up crying. "So terrible," she'd say. And John would take her in his arms, doing what he could, and then for a long while they would lie silently in the dark and take guesses at each other's thoughts. They were not ashamed. They knew all the wonderful reasons. They knew it was an accident of nature. They knew that biology should not dictate, that their lives were already far too complicated, that they were not yet prepared for the responsibilities and burdens. They understood all this. But lying there in the dark, they also understood that they had sacrificed some essential part of themselves for the possibilities of an ambiguous future. It was the guilt of a bad wager. They understood this too, and they felt the consequences. On January 18, 1986, in a Hilton ballroom 6 blocks from Kara's studio of magic, John Wade announced his candidacy for the United States Senate. Kathy was there, and Tony Carbo, and a happy-looking assembly of dignitaries in pinstripes and starched blue shirts. There was enthusiasm and good humor. John had the streamlined look of a winner. There was still a primary to get through, which could be tricky, but the polls had him 15 points up on an old war horse named Ed Durkee, his closest rival. Not a lock, but close enough. For well over a year, Tony had been fitting the pieces together, and in the ballroom that morning it was evident that his labors had paid off. People were smiling. The troops were in line. The appropriate blessings had been secured. John kept his speech short. He talked about fresh air and fresh starts. When it was over, the three of them took a cab across town to an expensive restaurant near the Capitol. John and Kathy ordered salads and vodka tonics. Tony had the pot roast special with a pair of bourbons. When the drinks came, Tony stood and raised his glass. He wore his green corduroy suit, freshly dry-cleaned, tight at the shoulders. "To freshman senators," he said. "Fresh air and fresh starts. Fresh new blood." "Amen," said Kathy, and laughed. Beneath the table, she put a hand on John's knee. The restaurant was full of the usual noontime pack of watchful lobbyists and string pullers. The background music was from Broadway. "So I guess we're off," Kathy said. "The press conference, it went all right?" Tony chuckled.
"Pretty all right. 4 TV crews, half the Star Tribune's newsroom. Couldn't do better for Mr. Goulet."
"Who?"
"Camelot. You're listening to him."
He sighed and cupped his hands at his belly.
"Mr. Who? Just proves you got to stay fresh."
Kathy smiled.
"But everything clicked?"
"Oh, sure. Hubby's a star."
"Well, good. Except it seemed..."
She hesitated and moved her hand along John's knee.
"I don't know. It just seemed a little empty, that's all. I'm not sure what the message was."
Tony winked at her.
"Win," he said.
"You aren't that cynical."
"No?"
"You're not."
"Well, gosh, you've got me semi-curious. What am I?"
His eyes glittered. He finished off one of the bourbons and tucked a napkin under his collar.
"Go on," he murmured. "Say nice things."
Kathy shrugged.
"Nothing, really. You put up that ridiculous front of yours, the cynic act. Down below, you're another poor, sad dreamer like the rest of us."
"Ah, I see. And the rest of us? Who be they?"
"Everybody. John and me."
Tony's pot roast came. He made a "may I" gesture, forked a potato, looked up at her with a half smile.
"John, you say? A dreamer?"
"Certainly."
"And where'd you dredge up this interesting theory?"
Nowhere, Kathy said. I married him.
Tony glanced over at John and chewed thoughtfully for a moment.
True enough, you married him, and what a happy stroke of fortune for the candidate.
Mind-boggling, I might add. Did I ever mention how spectacular you are?
Not nearly enough, Kathy said. I just wish you'd let him say things.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Which things are these? Which things would the candidate care to say?
John smiled. He was conscious of Kathy's hand on his knee.
Issues, he said. No big deal. Explain, Tony said. Honest, I'm dying to hear about these red-hot issues on your mind. Nuclear waste? Fresh plan for the isotopes?
Come on, man, don't start.
The welfare state? I'll bet that one keeps you awake at night. Aid to dependent children?
John's necktie felt tight. He turned toward Kathy and tried to firm up his lips.
He's right, I guess. First the election, then worry about the rest.
I see.
That doesn't...
Win and win again, Kathy said. And it won't ever stop, will it?
I didn't mean anything by that.
Win and win.
Tony Carbo looked on with a lazy smile.
Spectacular. I'm in love with the boss's wife.
Kathy's hand slipped away. For a while, they sat listening to the noontime clatter, the dishes and deal-making. Tony finally put his fork down.
Maybe I'm wrong, he said merrily. But it looks to me like this table could use a blow of fresh air. The lady's right, of course. It doesn't ever stop. Win and win and win. Very perceptive. On the other hand, there's this item called democracy. That's what all the nice patriotic folks call it. Count up the votes and deal out the power. The American way, tried and true. But see, here's the bizarre part. Those same nice folks get awful upset when somebody goes out and jumps into the trenches and tries to make it work. People get nasty, start calling you names.
Tony was smiling, but his manner didn't carry it off. He drained the second bourbon, looked up for a waiter.
The fact is, if you actually give a shit, if you bust your nuts and get involved and make it your life, well, fuck you. You're one more political dickhead. Gets to the edge of irony. All those holier-than-thou idiots out there, Fred Q. Public, dumb bastard can't find his own statehouse without Rand McNally and Shep the guide dog, watches a little TV news and calls himself a good citizen. Maybe votes once a year, probably doesn't. And guys like me, we're slick-dick Poles. We're a pack of thieves.
The smile was gone now. Tiny beads of sweat coated his forehead.
Anyhow, fuck that, he said. They want better? They can unass themselves. They can have this fucking job.
Kathy looked at him thoughtfully.
Hooray for you. A dreamer. So why not give John a chance?
Me?
See what happens.
Tony studied her for several seconds.
Sweet Kathleen, you don't get it, do you? Get it?
Hierarchy, he said, and smiled at John. The sorry truth is, I'm just one more hired gun. You want preacher politics? Talk to the boss here.
I don't see how that's
hubby's in charge, and I don't believe he's all that hot for issues right now. The man's got his priorities. Winning first, issues second. But go ahead and ask.
Kathy nodded. She sipped her drink, closed her eyes for a second, then excused herself and moved off toward the ladies' room. Tony watched until she was gone.
Yummy specimen, he said.
You didn't have to pull that stunt.
Stunt?
It wasn't necessary.
Tony grinned and wiped his mouth.
My apologies. Thinks you're Mr. Clean, doesn't she?
I am clean.
Of course, and absolutely.
Tony seemed amused as he took a bite of pot roast and scanned the room. It took him a long while to swallow.
However you want it.
Just seems a trifle odd how you stay so quiet on certain unnamed subjects.
Such as what?
Don't be a party pooper. If I named them, they wouldn't be unnamed, would they?
Bullshit, John said. That's a reach.
Probably so.
Tony saluted and pulled an imaginary trigger.
Anyhow, don't pin that ruthless crap on me. Things go wrong, man. I pity the poor fucker gets in your way. Real honest-to-God pity.
He wiggled his eyebrows. Still the old magician, right? Fool all the assholes some of the time, some of the assholes all the time. Can't fool Tony Carbo none of the time.
He nudged his plate aside and waved across the room.
And here she is, all freshly powdered. Weird thing, you know. Give me a shot. I'd drop 50 pounds for the lady. I do not joke.
Chapter 18. Hypothesis. When she cleared Magnuson's Island, Kathy gave the Evinrude an extra shot of gas and continued north past American Point and Buckeat Island, holding a course roughly west toward Angle Inlet. It was mostly open lake, wide and blue, and the boat planed along with a firm, rhythmic thump, the bow stiff against the waves. She felt better now. The morning sunshine helped. Here and there she passed little islands with forests pushing up flush against the shoreline, purely wild, too isolated for lumbering, everything thick and firm to her eye. The water itself seemed solid, and the sky, and the autumn air. Like flesh, she thought, like the tissue of some giant animal, a creature too massive for the compass of her city-block mind. All around her things were dense with color. On occasion she spotted a deserted fishing cabin, or a broken-down dock. But after a time the wilderness thickened and deepened and became complete. She could hear her thoughts unwinding. No more politics. Not ever again. All that was over. It was nothing. Less than nothing. And so she leaned back and gave the throttle a quarter turn, and allowed herself to open up to the sun and speed. A golden September day, fresh feeling, crisp and new, and everything was part of everything else. It all blended into a smooth, repetitive oneness. The trees and coves and water and sky, each piece of wilderness identical to every other piece. Kathy put a hand overboard, letting it trail through the water, watching its foamy imprint instantly close back on itself. Identical, which erased identity. Or it was all identity. An easy place, she thought, to lose yourself. Which is what happened, maybe. Maybe the singleness of things confused her. Maybe Buckeat Island was not Buckeat Island. Maybe she missed the channel into Angle Inlet by only a fraction of a mile. A miscalculation of gradient or degree. Daydreaming, maybe, or closing her eyes for an instant, or stretching out to absorb the fine morning sun. It was one possibility. No accident at all, just a banal human blunder. And she would have continued up the lake without worry, soon crossing into Canadian waters, into a great interior of islands and forests that reached northward over many hundred square miles. For well over an hour, she would have been lost without knowing how lost she was. Her eye was untrained. She had no instinct for the outdoors. She knew nothing about the sun's autumn angles, or how to judge true north, or where in nature to look for help. She was ignorant of even the most fundamental rule of the woods, which was to stop moving if ever in doubt, to take shelter and wait to be found. Almost certainly she would have tried to work her way out. Almost certainly she would have ended up hopelessly turned around. And so at some point that morning she must have felt the first soft nudge of anxiety. Too much time, she thought. Twice before with John she had made the trip by water into Angle Inlet, barely 40 minutes dock to dock. She looked at her wristwatch. The obvious thing was to start backtracking. Swing the boat south. Keep her eyes open.
She was in a wide, gently curving channel, flanked by four little islands, and for a few seconds she idled there, not sure about direction. She opened the red gas can, refueled, then turned the boat in a slow semicircle, and took aim at a stand of pines a mile or so back down the channel. The breeze had picked up now. Not quite a wind, but the waves stood higher on the lake, and the air was taking sharp bites at her neck and shoulders. There was no sound except for the rusty old Evinrude. Kathy buttoned up her sweater. No problem, she thought. Connect the dots. And then for well over an hour she held a line toward the southeast. It was thick, gorgeous country, everything painted in blues and greens, and the engine gave off a steady, burbling noise that reassured her. A good story for dinner. Danger and high adventure. It might give John a few things to think about, like the priorities in his life, and where his marriage ranked, and how he was in jeopardy of losing something more than an election. You could get lost in all sorts of ways, ways he'd never considered. And she'd tell him that. Humming to herself, Kathy adjusted the tiller and began planning a dinner menu. Two big steaks and salad and cold beer, imagining how she'd describe everything that was happening out here. Get some sympathy for herself. Get his attention for a change. The idea gave her comfort. She could almost picture a happy ending. After 20 minutes, the channel forked around a large, rocky island, narrowing for a mile, then breaking off into three smaller channels that curled away into the trees. The place struck her as both familiar and foreign. On a whim, she took the center channel and followed it through a funnel of pine and brush for what seemed far too long. Occasionally, the channel widened out, opening into pretty little bays and then closing up tight again. Like a river, she thought, except it didn't flow. The water beneath her had the feel of something static and purposeless, like her marriage, with no reality beyond its own vague alliance with everything else. Curiously, she felt no fear at all. It occurred to her that she was almost comfortable with the situation. She felt strong and capable. The same calm that came over her whenever she opened up a new crossword puzzle. All that stern geography to negotiate, a fixed grid full of hidden connections and hidden meanings. She liked unlocking things, finding solutions. For more than 20 years, she'd started the day with a crossword and a cup of coffee, easing into the daylight, enjoying the soft, flowering sensation that came into her bones as blocks of space suddenly took on clarity and design. It was more than habit. It was something in her genes. Even as a kid, she'd lived in a puzzle world, where surfaces were like masks, where the most ordinary objects seemed fiercely alive with their own sorrows and desires. She remembered giving secret names to things, carrying on conversations with chairs and trees. Peculiar, yes, but she couldn't help herself. It had always seemed so implausible that the world could be indifferent to its own existence. And although she'd long ago given up on churches, Kathy couldn't help believing in some fundamental governing principle beneath things, an aspect of consciousness that could be approached through acts of human sympathy. Like John, she thought. All that sadness under the flat gray surface of his eyes. A good feeling to be away from it. Ahead, the channel widened out into a stretch of open water, deep blue and icy-looking. She squinted up at the sun to calculate the remaining daylight. Maybe 5 hours until dark. Angle Inlet had to be somewhere off to the south, probably a shade to the west. She nodded to herself and said, "All right, fine," and fixed the boat on a southerly course, or what she took to be south, now and then checking her direction against the sun. The day was bright and windy, a string of filmy white clouds scudding eastward. She eased back on the throttle and for more than 2 hours moved through a chain of silvery bays and lakes that unfolded without stop to the horizon. There were no cabins, no other boats. Along the shoreline, thick growths of cattails bent sideways in the wind, and there were occasional flights of ducks and loons, but mostly it was a dull succession of woods and water. After a time, she felt a detached laziness come over her, a shutting-down sensation. At one point, she found herself singing old nursery songs. Later on, she laughed at the memory of one of Harmon's filthy jokes. A chipmunk. A deaf rhinoceros. A spasm of guilt went through her. Not that she'd ever loved the man, not even close. But there was still the shame of what had happened back then. She pictured his bare white chest, the fingers so thick and stubby for someone who made a living at dentistry. Hard to believe she'd felt things for him. Enough, she thought. Leave it alone. Still, it was hard to keep her mind on the boat. Hard to sustain much resolve. Overhead, a big pale sun burned without heat. The day was slowly tilting toward shadow. Her mind, too. "Harmon, Harmon," she said. 5 minutes later, she ran out of gas. The abrupt quiet surprised her. Even with the wind, the afternoon seemed hugely empty. She was bobbing 30 yards off the shore of another small wooded island. For a few minutes, Kathy sat still. What she needed, really, was a nap. Curl up and let the waves rock her to sleep. Instead, she got to her knees, opened the red gas can, and carefully refilled the Evinrude's tank. At least she'd had enough foresight to stow the extra fuel. And the thing now was not to waste any. A good, steady speed, straight lines from point to point. She closed her eyes and jiggled the can. Estimated another 4 gallons or so, which was plenty. She said it aloud. Plenty. Then bent forward and yanked on the starter cord. The Evinrude gave off a weak whine. She tried again twice more, but there was nothing. Good thoughts, Kathy told herself. Good thoughts for good girls. She gripped the cord with both hands, braced herself, and pulled back hard. There was a short coughing sound. The Evinrude sputtered, then caught. Kathy gave it some throttle. Good thoughts for good girls. It was one of those proverbs her Girl Scout leader used to clip out of Methodist magazines and recite to the troops as a way of bludgeoning them toward rectitude. The old lady, Mrs. Brandt, she had banality to burn. A jingle for every occasion. Birthdays, menstruation, first love. Kathy couldn't help smiling as she turned the boat back into open lake. Never pout, never doubt. That's our famous Girl Scout. Right now, though, it was hard to push away the apprehension. The shadows were rapidly lengthening, and in the air there was the crisp, metallic scent of winter. A shift in the ozone, maybe. Mrs. Brandt would have been ready with all the technical details. When you're lost, look for the moss. It's on the north, so sally forth. It took almost 20 minutes to cross the open water. This time there were no channels south. Directly ahead, the shoreline loomed up as a blunt, gently curving mass of rock and pines, a long green wall arcing out in front of her as far as she could see. Kathy cut back on the power, idling offshore, trying to settle on a proper course of action. Nothing sensible revealed itself. She gazed at the dense forest, then up at the sky. The facts seemed obvious, lost and totally alone. And the physical universe had no opinion. Trees did not talk, no face behind the clouds, no natural laws, only nature. Which was the truth, she told herself, so she might as well get on with it. She brought the boat around and followed the shoreline in what she took to be a generally westward direction, looking for a channel south. The afternoon had passed to a ghostly gray. She was struck by the immensity of things, so much water and sky and forest. And after a time it occurred to her that she'd lived a life almost entirely indoors. Her memories were indoor memories, fixed by ceilings and plastered white walls. Her whole life had been locked to geometries,
suburban rectangles, city squares. First, the house she'd grown up in, then dorms and apartments. The open air had been nothing but a medium of transit, a place for rooms to exist. Very briefly, closing her eyes, Kathy felt the need to cry. Her throat tightened up. "Don't be an idiot," she said. "Just find a goddamned way." And then for a long while she followed the curving shoreline, moving at low throttle, watching the sun sink toward the trees straight ahead. The wind was colder now. She passed between a pair of tiny islands, veered north to skirt a spit of rocks and sand, then aimed the boat west into a wide stretch of choppy water. After more than an hour, nothing much had changed. The purest wilderness, everything tangled up with everything else. At best, she decided, the day contained another half hour of useful light, 20 minutes to be safe. She hesitated, then turned in toward a small dome-shaped island off to her left. No choice, she thought. Get some sleep. Start fresh. 30 yards offshore, she cut the power. Already dusk was coming down hard. The little island seemed to float before her in the purply twilight, partly masked by a strand of reeds and cattails. She unlashed the oars, set them in their locks, and began pulling in toward what appeared to be a narrow strip of beach beyond the reeds. It was harder work than she would have guessed. The waves kept turning her, and after only a few strokes she felt a dull ache settle into her neck and shoulders. Twice she got caught in the reeds and had to back off and pick out a new angle of approach. On the third try she stopped and pulled up the oars. "For Pete's sake," she said, "you're not a child." She stripped off her sneakers and jeans, moved to the stern, hopped out into thigh-deep water. The quick cold made her skin tighten. Partly wading, partly swimming, she got behind the boat and wrestled it through the cattails and up onto the narrow beach. She used the bow line to secure the boat to a big birch and then lay back on the sand to let herself breathe. It felt good to have ground beneath her. The darkness now was almost complete. 6 o'clock, she guessed. For a few minutes she lay listening to things, the waves and nighttime insects. Then she got up and took off her underpants and wrung them out. In the boat she found an oilcloth to dry herself. She put on her jeans, slicked her hair back, used the last slivers of dusk to do an inventory. There wasn't much. No matches or lighter. Nothing to eat. She had the life vest, which she now slipped on for warmth, and she had her wallet and a pack of lifesavers, and a tackle box and some Kleenex, and the gasoline and the 2 oars and the boat. In her pockets, she found a comb and a few coins. She dragged the boat higher up onto the beach, wedged a couple of rocks under the stern. It wasn't a beach, really. Just a ledge of sand jutting out from the main body of the island. It was shaped something like an arrowhead, 40 or 50 feet wide at the base, narrowing toward the tip. Behind her, where the ledge hooked up with the rest of the island, she could make out a long, dark smudge of heavy forest. Kathy spanked her hands together. "Well, let's go," she said, which gave her confidence. Quickly, she moved to the tree line and collected an armful of pine boughs and carried them over to a level spot beside the boat. In 5 minutes, she had a mattress. She covered it with the oilcloth and sat down. Good enough, she decided. And nothing more could be done until morning. She took out a lifesaver, leaned back against the boat, and looked up at a bright yellow moon rising over the pines to the north. She wouldn't starve. Plenty of fish in the lake, mushrooms and berries, all kinds of things. Right now, she thought, John would be getting a search organized. Helicopters and floodlights, a whole army of Girl Scouts out beating the bush. Things would work out. She was strong. Good health, good brains. Yes, and in the morning she'd get out the tackle box and do some trolling. Pull in a nice big breakfast. Find a way to make a fire. Then look for a channel south. Keep going until somebody found her. or until she ran dead on into the Minnesota mainland. Easy, she thought, like 1, 2, 3. Kathy pulled her arms inside the life vest. For a while she listened to the waves.